Hey there, everybody. It is Thursday, August 8th, 2013, and you are listening to this show, So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. And of course, right there on our homepage, you can join our $10,000 challenge, where we're trying to get 1,000 people to donate $10 each to raise money for the San Francisco to LA AIDS ride. Right there on our homepage at thisshowissogay.com. You can follow us on Twitter. We're bound to start using it at some point, maybe with more followers. I don't know. But we are using Facebook, so go to the Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have such a jam-packed show for you this week. And we start off with a guest who is making his triumphant sixth appearance on our show. But here's the deal. I went back over his other five appearances, and we have always put him in at the end of the show. We throw him in at the end, we talk about his blogs, and he doesn't get really a full introduction, and we're always time crunched, so we're putting him at the top of the show for a full introduction. Jimmy Nguyen is an award-winning digital media and technology lawyer, speech expert, diversity advocate, blogger, and media commentator. He hosts the Speak Up with Jimmy web series, which covers people and topics to help everyone speak up, speak out, and speak well. He is a creative producer of the It Gets Better touring theater show, which we've talked about a ton on our show. He's won awards. I'm going to even have time to say his awards. In 2008, Law Dragon named Jimmy one of the 500 leading lawyers in America. And in 2010, The Advocate named him to its 40 under 40 list of our top LGBT persons, which he's going to try to get me onto next year. In 2012, he was included in a Huffington Post list of the most influential LGBT Asian icons. He writes for his own website, JimmyNguyen.com, and he just launched Diverse Story Project, a new online campaign, which we're going to talk all about. Jimmy Nguyen, welcome back to The Show Is So Gay.
Wow, Ken. Geez, I didn't know the power of being first up on one of your show episodes. Thanks for that introduction. And I will say I am a proud follower on Facebook and Twitter of you, and This Show Is So Gay.
Look at that.
Because they are a true win.
They are a true win. It's different being here at the top of the show. Do you know that you actually have not been on the show in 8 months? It feels like yesterday.
It's been a while. Yeah. I've been, you know, busy working on other projects, but thank you for number six, and maybe we'll get to lucky number seven sometime soon.
You have taken the lead. You have taken the title from singer-songwriter Eric Hyman. It's a back-and-forth battle on who appears most on our show.
Oh, well, you know, I always, you know, like to win.
Well, because you're at the top of the show and because we just have time, we can talk more about you. I actually did go back and listen to your past appearances on the show, and I feel like we haven't really gone through your backstory, which will, of course, lead into your new online campaign. But for folks who don't know, you were born in South Vietnam.
That is correct, yeah. No, it's an important part of my life story. I was born in Saigon, and I was 2.5 years old when Saigon fell to North Vietnam Communist forces in April 1975. My family was pretty fortunate to be helped out of Saigon the night before Saigon fell, rather than being part of that whole, you know, wave of refugees people remember seeing on TV, you know, clinging onto helicopters and trying to get on boats the next day. My father was a judge in the South Vietnamese court system, the equivalent of a French magistrate judge, which is very powerful under that system. And my mom's brother was in the military, and so we were helped out of the country by the U.S. government, given the government official relationships, and in particular for my dad. He would have been put in what is nicely called a political re-education camp, I'm sure, had my family not been able to flee Vietnam. And we were helped by the U.S. government out of the country and eventually resettled into Southern California, where I grew up. So I'm kind of a California boy by way of South Vietnam. So that immigrant part of my life has informed much of my life perspective.
And your father, like many folks who came to this country, had to find different employment than that which employed him in Vietnam.
Yeah, that's I get a little emotional about that because, you know, my father always wanted one of his sons to become a lawyer. My older brother did not. I ended up becoming a lawyer. And in part, I think it's because I watched what my parents try to do. They didn't speak any English when they came to the United States. So they're plopped into a country, sort of helped by a church that sponsored them into the country to, you know, get an apartment, a new new life, put in English classes, and just taking odd jobs. So my dad, who was the guy who wielded justice from a court bench in Vietnam, got his first American job as an orderly in a nursing facility.
Wow.
And my mom worked in a big giant sewing factory. But those were the only kind of jobs they could get at the time, not, you know, speaking any English at the time. And my dad, you know, ended up working for the U.S. Postal Service. He was a mailman for a long time. He delivered mail, and he then ended up working in the office, and my mom ended up working at the Postal Service, too. But I remember my dad, at a certain point, trying to take the California bar exam to try and practice law in the United States, and he got a waiver of the educational requirement given his law degree from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I have these pictures of him studying at his little desk with Barbary bar exam review books. And he took the exam, did not pass, which, you know, was not surprising given that English is not his native language and law is a very language-based profession.
Oh, yeah.
And he still even has his little admission card for the bar exam to this day, which I think is really great because it was important for him, I think, to at least try. And then he sort of gave up on that because he had to work jobs to, you know, support a family. And with, you know, four kids in the family and my mom and dad working odd jobs, and he just didn't have time to continue studying for the bar exam. So I sort of became the son who followed in his legal footsteps.
Which came first, you coming out as a lawyer or you coming out as gay?
I think I came out as a lawyer first.
Okay.
And probably it was from my speech debate experience in high school and college, I always thought about law. And so I think I figured that out, even though I think I knew I was gay at the time, but I didn't come out about it. Although, when I look back, I actually came out in life in law school. So maybe it was all happening around the same time.
Gotcha. And we've talked previously on this show about the particular challenges of coming out in an immigrant family. Is that something that you experienced?
Yeah, I think it's challenging for anyone, but for me, I think my parents knew for a long time that I was gay. We just sort of never talked about it,
right.
And I didn't really have the direct conversation with them until I was in my 30s, if you can believe it, which is surprising for someone like me who's very, you know, out and outspoken now in life. But a lot of that had to do with sort of Asian family upbringing, where I think that's true for many Asian American families, where you just don't talk about your emotions a lot.
Right.
You know, I don't remember being asked when I was a kid what I felt, you know, or what I liked to do. And I don't fault my parents for that. I think that's just kind of how they were culturally, and we didn't talk about things. And we also had this bit of a language barrier where my parents would speak to me in Vietnamese, and my Vietnamese, even though I spoke it as a kid, it grew, you know, less effective over the years since I would speak back to them in English. It became hard to have very personal conversations.
Yeah.
And then when you're an immigrant to the United States, I think families just feel very alien. You feel very different, right? And so I think there's a tendency for a lot of immigrant parents to sort of keep their kids close to home and protect them. And then as a child, you feel, I think, extra pressure to really succeed and be the embodiment of your parents' dreams because, like my father, he couldn't have his legal dream in the U.S., so a lot of that became personified through me. So I think there's an extra pressure on you to satisfy parents' expectations.
Oh, yeah.
And it makes it a little even harder to go through the step of coming out as gay to your parents, who are immigrants and Asian from a conservative, you know, culture.
Yeah. I have to say, as someone whose parents desperately wanted him to be a lawyer, that was a hard trend to buck there.
Well, you know, be glad you didn't become a lawyer because you would spend your day like me reading lots of long documents with very small print.
But I used to watch Matlock, so I think I can do it.
Yeah, it's not the same.
Okay. That's really – do you know how many hopes and dreams you just dashed with those few words right there?
I'm a dream killer.
When you come back on the show next, I'm adding that to your bio, dream killer.
Yeah, dream killer. You know, I'm glad you asked me about, you know, the life story because I, and leading to our conversation about the Diverse Story Project, have been had my life really shaped by the fact that I was an immigrant and Asian American and then one day realizing I was gay. So it's like this whole life experience I've had about just feeling different in many respects. You know, the joke I make is that if I have to check off demographic boxes. I fit most of them, except, you know, if I was a lesbian, then, you know, then I could check off the gender box as well. Because I'm also left-handed, you know, and we're a minority.
Yeah, you are. You are. But very good tennis players, I must tell you. So that's a good thing.
Yeah.
You mentioned speech and debate, and gosh knows for going on 5 years now of This Show Is So Gay, we talk about the importance of voice. Speech and debate, pretty core to who you are.
Totally. I would not be the person I am today without having entered the competitive world of forensics, which is the term for speech and debate, in high school and college. It started, I had entered the speech contest when I was in elementary school that I won, and I did some more speech competition type things in junior high. And then in my high school, I was lucky enough to go to a high school which had a speech team, and I sort of answered a call to enter the speech tournament one day. And I was super shy as a kid, which nobody believes now, because anyone who knows me goes, wow, you're so, you know, bright, shiny star. And I said, no, I was super shy. But there was something about getting up at my first speech tournament, giving a speech that I prepared, where there was like a little light switch that turned on in my back. And all of a sudden, it was like, bam, I figured out who I was. So I competed all through high school and college, and I helped coach a college speech team for many years, including with my friend Liesl Reinhardt, who you
love
had on the show
her.
As well. And it led me to just sort of figure out who I was, to express who I was. It's one of my great gifts in life, I think, and I really enjoyed the process of, for years, helping coach other people, get them to believe they can be better speakers, whether they win a national championship or not. And now a lot of my, you know, professional endeavors are geared towards getting people to speak up in life and speak out.
Well, let me challenge that a little bit, because, you know, we're always trying to get people to speak up, but I think as you've experienced, the packaging of it kind of does matter in our social media age. Like, not just, yes, I have something to say, but the way that you deliver it does have some import.
Absolutely, because I think we're in an age, particularly in the digital media world with my digital media hat on, where we're inundated with messaging now. There's almost too much communication coming at us. So first, I think you have to figure out what you have that's genuine and important to say. You know, don't say something just for the sake of saying something. Find something unique and genuine to say. And second, figure out how to say it effectively. And whatever means that is, whether it's through social media, through personal conversations, through blogging, whatever it is, just find the most effective route for it. But I think it starts by figuring out what to say. And the journey I'm on now, it's interesting because, you know, I'm doing all these media activities, which a lot of people in my life thought I should have done many years ago. But I don't think I would have been as effective when in my 20s doing it, because I would have been just the guy doing things in media just to get attention rather than actually having life experience and personal revelations of myself to actually talk about.
Right.
And use as a background to help inspire other people.
Whatever. You're in your early 30s. It's time enough.
I'm 40 now.
No, I don't accept that. And before we get to your current project, what is the deal with you and pageants?
What is it? Oh, so that's
I don't
a really
understand.
Good question.
You're a pageant judge?
Yes. I have been a preliminary judge, not the final telecast judge, a preliminary judge at the last two Miss Universe pageants, in Las Vegas in 2012 and the year before 2011 in Sao Paulo, Brazil. It's a long story of how I got there, but when I was a little kid.
Is it sorted? Because I think it's sorted.
It is a little sorted.
Okay,
but why do you think it's sorted?
I don't know. I just feel like there's some good sorted story that resulted in you going to Brazil to be a preliminary judge for the Miss Universe pageant. I'm sorry. It doesn't just happen.
Well, I've always been fascinated by pageants since I was a kid. When I was a kid, this gets to the diversity issue as well, my mom used to watch pageants on TV because pageants are really big in Vietnamese culture. And so she used to watch the Miss Universe pageant, and I would be fascinated by it. Probably as a growing, you know, young little gay boy, I liked the sequins and sparkles and the glamour of it all. But it was the only time in the late 70s and early 80s that I saw on television people who weren't white. Because it's a worldwide pageant, unlike, for example, the Miss USA pageant, where the contestants are predominantly Caucasian, the Miss Universe pageant, you have people from all over the country. So I would see Asian people on TV that I would never see otherwise. And so I would always be rooting for them, and, you know, invariably they usually would not win. But that's why I got fascinated by the Miss Universe pageant. And fast forward, and I'll tell you a little secret. This is probably the most sordid thing you'll get out of me, is when I was a kid, my sister Patty and I used to collect a whole, you know, trove of stuffed animals. We had a little city, we called them, of these stuffed animals. And I used to hold stuffed animal beauty pageants and make my sister sit and judge them.
Who would win?
Usually it was Sandy the teddy bear, because I could wrap this towel around her really well to make a great evening gown.
Oh, Jimmy,
I'm the tallest, because height makes a difference in those pageants. So fast forward to my adult
I am so life. Rarely speechless, and yet, right there in that moment. Yes, go ahead, flash forward to you as an
fast
adult.
Fast forward to my adult life. I, with my ex-boyfriend, he was a telecast judge at the Miss USA pageant a few years ago, and I attended the pageant and there got to meet a lot of pageant people, including people at the Miss Universe organization, just got to know them, and through a whole chain of events that led me to being invited one day to judge the Miss Universe pageant. I also represent the Miss Universe pageant as a lawyer now, so it's one of my clients.
Wow. Has your favorite, anyone you picked in the preliminary rounds, have they done well?
Well, I am sworn to secrecy through my obligations as a preliminary judge, but I can say that the winners of the last two pageants are definitely, you know, at the Miss Universe pageant, are definitely people that I think were worthy.
All right. We'll go with that. Please say that somewhere there is a picture of these stuffed animal pageants.
You know, I don't know. I'm going to have to ask my sister about that. I don't know that, because, you know, that was not at a digital time, right?
Right.
Where, you know, you can take pictures and they're on Facebook somewhere or save somewhere. That was during the old snap and shoot and take your film to, you know, get developed days. So I don't know that there is any, but if anyone would have it, it would be my sister Patty.
I'm going to get in touch with her first before you will. So that brings us to your current online campaign, which is just so exciting and for so many levels for me, and we'll talk about those intersections. Talk to me about the Diverse Story Project.
Okay, well, thank you for having me on to talk about the Diverse Story Project. It's a new campaign that's near and dear to my heart, and it's based on the philosophy that I came to realize. It's so simple, yet I think so important, that diversity is just about all of us having a different life story or different life experiences, and everybody has what I call a diverse story, including straight white men. And the reason this was important to me is it all came from an diversity innovation talk I was asked to give at my law firm's biannual retreat earlier this year in April. And so I was asked to give a talk about how we could, as a legal service provider, be more innovative, you know, when it comes to diversity.
Yeah, if we could pause right there for a second, because I was reading you, and we will link to it. You have a whole post on the Huffington Post about some of the origins of this. And when I read that piece, I will say that my back went up a little bit. Like, okay, was there a tokenism thing going on here that you were asked to give this presentation?
Well, you know, a good question. I'm a longtime diversity advocate in the legal community. I've been involved in, for example, California's leading legal diversity organization at all of my law firms. I've been really involved in diversity initiatives. So when they needed someone to talk about diversity, you know, I was, you know, one of the natural possible choices in the firm.
Gotcha.
Now, it so happens, of course, that I'm a Asian American, you know, gay person. And so is it tokenism? You know, it's hard to say. Could they have asked a straight white male to deliver the speech? Certainly. You would have to find the appropriate person who had something to say about it.
Right.
And I think there's a great value in the business world these days of having straight white men really being involved in leadership with diversity, so
right,
that it doesn't look like there are minority or people or diverse professionals just trying to do things to advantage themselves.
Okay.
So, you know, I don't know, but I was, you know, I think people thought I was asked because they thought, you know, you're a great speaker, you're inspirational, and you're really involved in diversity efforts.
Let's go with that.
So I was happy to do it, but where I struggled with the speech is it was supposed to be an innovation talk about something to do that's innovative. And I kept thinking, well, geez, what the heck is there innovative to say about diversity? Because if you're involved in diversity in corporate environments, we've been having the same conversation, I feel like, for, you know, all the years I've been involved in those efforts, which is over 10 now. I sit in these meetings and we say the same things. You know, we need to provide more opportunities for diverse professionals in hiring, in retention, in promotional and professional development, but things don't really change that much, particularly in law.
Right.
So I was thinking, what could I say to a room full of lawyers that would be innovative about diversity? And it occurred to me that I needed to find a way to engage the straight white men in the room.
Yeah.
Because in law firms, not just mine, but most major American law firms, you know, the lawyers are still, for the most part, straight white men. You know, there are diverse lawyers, but, you know, there's not as much diversity as you would like. And we needed to get them really involved in the conversation and figuring out what they could do. So it dawned on me one day when I was thinking about this speech, you know what? They have a diverse story, too. And one of the things I hear often is that straight white men feel excluded from the diversity conversation, or worse, made to feel that diversity problems are their fault, that somehow, you know, the fact that there's not as many opportunities for someone like me or an African-American female is the fault of the straight white men in the organization. And so I think I needed to get people over that. So I came up with this concept that everyone has a diverse story. And I asked people to think, what's yours? And I went to my firm and I picked a number of white attorneys in the firm, purposely just the white attorneys, and asked them to tell me a story of how diversity shaped their life. And I took those stories, folded into a speech, in particular got stories from straight white men that were really inspirational, really moving, and I gave the speech and I told these stories about how there's all this diversity in the firm, including among the white lawyers, and as lawyers and as a firm, we just have to start telling these stories more, incorporating them into our hiring and business approach with our clients, and that will help move the needle towards better diversity and inclusion. So I got some great stories. There was, you know, the straight white male partner in my New York office who calls himself an honorary lesbian and doesn't even consider himself straight white male because he's got two lesbian sisters. And a partner, you know, our managing partner of the firm from Portland who grew up with his friends being a Mexican-American family that were nearby, and he spent, you know, his whole childhood, you know, making tamales and having Christmas Eve parties to eat them and, you know, not thinking about the fact that his friends didn't look like him.
Talk to me about the word diversity, because that I want to even go basic on that, because there are many articles, particularly on college campuses, where there's a lot of kind of racism bound up with the word diversity, and there's some folks straying away from it as something to be avoided and not something to be embraced, that it's just a way of marginalizing people further. But I see you really exemplifying the word and reclaiming it and celebrating it.
I'm trying to. I think, yes, there has been, you know, confusion about what the goals of diversity movements are, and I can understand why there is a reluctance to adopt more fully affirmative action plans. I think in some environments they're definitely needed. In other environments, you know, you have to be more cautious because, you know, for example, in my law firm environment that I live in professionally, yeah, you don't want people to feel that you're giving unfair advantages to diverse attorneys just because they're diverse, right? I think you want people to feel like everyone is succeeding on merit. What I'm trying to capture is not the sense of trying to give advantages to diverse people. It's about celebrating the fact that we all have something different about our life, whether you're gay or you're African American or you're from another country or you have a disability or you're a veteran or, you know, whatever it may be, or you're left-handed.
Right.
And that all of us have something diverse about us, and that if we talk about it more, share our stories, then we will get better as a community and as a country about talking about our differences, recognizing how that makes us all special, and maybe we'll understand each other a little bit better.
Well, speaking of our country, you know, we are nothing in our efforts if not for the context that we place them in. And certainly in your Huffington Post piece, you give a shout out to the Trayvon Martin verdict and the trial and really national sentiment around it. How does that influence what it is that you're trying to do?
You know, it's interesting. I started this diverse story project concept before a lot of the media firestorm hit about the George Zimmerman verdict and, you know, what happened in the Trayvon Martin case.
Yeah.
So I didn't plan it this way, but when the Diverse Story Project launched, it happened to coincide with the verdict coming out and a lot of dialogue in our country about, you know, whether what happened was due to racial issues or not. And what I notice is that we could do better as a country, and this has been true for a long time, at talking about racial issues.
Right.
And that's the context I wanted to fit the Diverse Story Project in, which is an improvement of racial literacy and literacy of all diverse categories. And what I mean by that is I think sometimes people shy away from talking about race. That when things happen in the world, such as the George Zimmerman verdict, you know, people start, they either talk about race too disrespectfully or they avoid talking about it at all because they don't want to offend anyone.
Right.
And I don't think either is the solution to America's racial divides. The fact that we have different races in this country and that there are historical racial problems is completely undeniable. Let's not pretend it doesn't exist. Let's acknowledge that it exists. Let's acknowledge that we have different races, and let's get better at talking about our racial differences in a way that's more respectful. And I think if we share our stories of how we're all different, then we'll get in a better habit of being able to talk to each other and ask questions about our differences in a way that's not just respectful, but inviting and fun and inspirational. And so that's how I think this all fits in with the George Zimmerman case, which is I'm telling the world, yes, some people think there are racial issues behind the George Zimmerman verdict. You can disagree or not disagree about it, but let's not pretend that people's interpretation of the verdict is not affected by their race.
Right.
And use the opportunity to then talk about, well, why is that the case? You know, we'll never really know whether the verdict was affected by race or not. You know, that's only in the hearts and minds of those jurors, right? But the fact that African Americans have a totally different interpretation of what happened is fueled by their different life experience, their diverse story. Let's acknowledge that they had a different diverse story, encourage them to talk about it, and encourage the rest of the country to at least listen to what they have to say.
Yeah. Well, look, I love the shout out that you gave in the Huffington Post piece and in the other literature just about that white people do have a voice. And I have to say, look, this is what I do. I teach race and education. It's the course I teach almost every semester. I will say the most difficult semester I've ever had teaching race and education was with an all-white class because the perception was, well, we can't speak for anyone else, and nor am I asking you to. But that is not to say that you don't have a voice. And if this conversation is totally fear-based, I actually had to change the name of the course to Talking Race in Education to remind my students that they actually needed to speak in the course.
And, right.
And their whiteness wasn't, you know, a cover to just sit in the back and not say anything. Well, we can't speak for someone else. Not
I think that's such a powerful point, because I think we'll do better at race relations in our country if white people start being able to talk about how they're affected by race.
Right, exactly.
Or in both positive and negative ways. And yes, maybe some bigotry will come out, but maybe some positive things will come out, because
right.
We can't deny they're affected by race, just like straight people are affected constantly by LGBT people somehow in life.
Indeed.
Let's talk about it. Let's share the story about, you know, the fact that you lived, who knows, in a predominantly African-American neighborhood, like one of my partners in our Portland office. When she was a kid, she was a Jewish kid growing up in an African-American neighborhood and trying to bring lox and bagels to class. She's white, but she should talk about that because it informs her life experience. And even though that's positive, there may be negative experiences that I think if we encourage people to talk about, hopefully we get to better racial dialogue.
Jimmy Nguyen encouraging people to use their voice. Where can folks go to learn more about this amazing campaign?
Well, thanks for asking. The campaign website is diversestory.org. That's diversestory.org. Or they can follow the online campaign at on Facebook and on Twitter at Diverse Story. And most importantly, I'm encouraging people to submit their own diverse stories, either by video or a written story. I got my first written story submission last week from a teacher at this special school in New York, the Manhattan Country School, which enrolled a very diverse student population, both not just racially but also socioeconomically, because they have a sliding scale tuition so that parents pay what they can. And so that's a really great way to try and get a more diverse student population at a small private school in New York. So submit your stories. I would love to have them. I would love to feature them. You can join people like my friend Brooke Lee, Miss Universe 1997, who's got one of the first diverse story videos on the site.
So exciting. Hey, can we do our regular segment called Win with Legal Jimmy? Okay, I got to rename it. But we covered a legal story last week that we wanted to get your take on. I learned all about Batson versus Kentucky, about whether or not jurors can be disqualified. And I guess there's a big case there in California right now, whether a juror, it was okay for the juror to be disqualified for being gay.
Yes. What would you like to know about that?
Is that good?
Well, Batson versus Kentucky is this U.S. Supreme Court case from, 20 plus years ago, which deals with the question of what's called a peremptory challenge, which is when you are as a lawyer and you're in a trial and jurors, potential jurors are getting put into the box, as we say, you could just strike somebody without any reason, right? You usually get a certain number of them. But there was accusations that lawyers were using them, particularly on the prosecutor's side, in ways that were striking people based on race, you know, not just because, oh, I don't think this person is going to be a good juror, but I'm striking, for example, all the black people.
Right.
Right. And so a case went up to the U.S. Supreme Court about that, and the U.S. Supreme Court found that a prosecutor that used peremptory challenges, this was in a criminal case, just to dismiss jurors, you can't use that to strike people solely based on race. And so the question, because that raises a equal protection question under our 14th Amendment, that I think you're addressing is, well, can you use these peremptory challenges to strike people based purely on sexual orientation? You know, I'm going to get rid of all the gay people, so I have no gay people on a jury.
Are we okay with that in Jimmy's legal opinion?
Well, in my legal opinion, I think that would really be a bad policy to set. You know, it gets to this interesting question, which the Supreme Court of the United States still hasn't quite gotten to, which is sexual orientation a protected class
right.
that is of the same caliber of protection as race or gender, for example? Being an LGBT rights advocate would put it in the same category.
Okay.
And say, just as you can't strike people from a jury solely based on race, you shouldn't strike people from a jury solely based on sexual orientation. Because imagine, for example, let's say someone had a wrongful termination lawsuit and they were claiming they were, you know, fired for being gay. And if a lawyer could strike all the gay people from the jury just because they were gay, you know, and you could establish that they were doing that intentionally, is that a good thing for society? I don't think so.
Certainly not a good thing for the gays.
Yeah.
Just
no.
putting that out.
I think, you know, people, lawyers strike, you know, potential jurors for all kinds of reasons. There's strategy involved. I'm not saying you shouldn't be able to use these peremptory challenges. That's part of our system. We as lawyers have to, you know, use our strategy that is in the best interest of our client. But if you do it in a way that excludes entire categories of people from having a voice in our jury system, I think that's a problem.
I still think my years of Matlock enabled me to try these cases, but I guess not. I guess not. Well, look at all the things we get to talk about when you're at the top of the show.
Wow. This was a cornucopia of content.
Well, look, any project, particularly by someone we adore like you, that gets people to use their voice is surely a win, and so gay in a good way in our book. So everybody strolling over, we will link up to the Diverse Story Project. Jimmy, what a great project.
Thanks so much, and thanks for having me on, and I hope your listeners check it out and submit their own stories of how diversity shaped their life, because everyone has a diverse story.
They indeed do. Thank you, Jimmy.
Thanks.
Sometimes I'm right, but I could be wrong. My own beliefs are in my song. The butcher, the banker, the drummer, and then
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, our jam-packed show continues. This is so exciting. We welcome to the show Elijah Oberman, who is a founding member and the violinist for the Shondas, just one of the most incredible indie rock bands out there. I have seen them multiple times in concert. They self-released their first LP, The Red Sea, in 2008. They followed that up with My Dear One in 2010 and then Searchlights in 2011. Their latest release is called The Garden, and it's coming out in just a few weeks in September. We will be debuting a track, that's right, debuting a track from that album right here on this week's episode. But first, Elijah, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Oh, thank you so much, Ken. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be on. I've never been on the show before.
We have so much to discuss. I'm almost a little nervous for you.
Don't be nervous.
Okay.
Be nervous.
Let's start where we start with all of our musical people. Tell our listening audience, Elijah, why music? Why the medium of music to express yourself?
That's a really fantastic question. I actually don't think anyone's ever asked me that. You know, I think that there is something about music because it is so emotional, that is, you know, because it makes people feel so much that it's just, in a way, it's just the easiest way to sort of break down, the barriers between people having a conversation. You know, when you're moved by music and when you're playing music or you're listening to music or you're at a live show, I just think it goes straight to the heart and, you know, I always think that's a pretty good place to start.
Yeah. Now, I read online that you and your violin have quite the relationship. Is it true? Does it go all the way back to Peter and the Wolf?
It goes back, you wouldn't believe, even farther than Peter and the
Come
Wolf.
Come on!
I know. So, yes, no, when I was 4 years old, my father took me to go see a live performance of Peter and the Wolf, which, if any of your listeners don't know, is, you know, is where each character in the story is represented by a different instrument, and Peter, the main character, is represented by the violin. And I was so into it, and I came home, we came home, and I, you know, begged my father to let me play violin, and he started weeping. And the reason for that is that what I didn't know is that his entire side of the family for generations had been violent.
No way.
Yes. So it goes back even farther. And there were a couple cellists in there. But, yeah, I had a great-great uncle who played in the Budapest String Quartet and a great uncle who actually is who I've never met, who I need to meet, who's still living, who lives in Nashville and is basically the go-to guy for all the string arrangements in country music. So,
wow.
Yeah, quite a legacy.
And this was a transition I wasn't even planning on. It's so funny that you use the word weeping because so many different reviews of your music mention Elijah's weeping violin.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, it's funny. A teacher of mine who is no longer with us, who I think about all the time, you know, she said, you're supposed to make your violin weep and you're supposed to make your violin laugh. And I think I'm still working on the laughing part, but I do seem to have the weeping part sound pretty well.
There you go. See, I loved Peter. I loved the oboes in Peter and the Wolf. What were those, the ducks?
Oh, yes, the ducks. The grandfather was the bassoon.
Wow.
I also, after this transformative experience, I did a 45-minute long interpretive dance piece that I made up.
Of course you did.
Yes, to the entire thing and the recorded version, which I would perform for myself alone in my backyard on Long Island. So.
Now, Elijah, I was not able to find that interpretive dance on YouTube. Will it be going up anytime soon?
God, no, it is closely guarded by my mother down in Charlottesville, Virginia. So, you know, if I have any real stalkers, you know, you can try to get it from her. But no, luckily, and it's only on VHS, so good luck with that.
I'm on it. There are people who convert that to DVD, so I'm all set with that. Well, that brings us to the Shondas, who I've seen you guys. You guys were in Brattleboro, Vermont, and...
Oh, I was wondering where you'd seen us.
I had seen you in Brattleboro, Vermont. You guys have just been all over, and you obviously know you guys put on an amazing live show.
Thanks. our performing live is my absolute favorite part of the band, and I do love recording and being in the studio, and I love songwriting and band practice, but there's really just nothing like performing, and it's funny because it did not come naturally to me. For a long time, I would have panic attacks or near panic attacks before we went on stage. It was very difficult for me. I'm like not a natural performer, but once I sort of got over a certain hump, I just think that there's something so freeing about it, you know.
Yeah.
And as someone who grew up playing classical music, where everything is about an extreme level of perfection, there's something, and that I really internalized that and was so hard on myself, and it was so hard to actually enjoy music anymore because of it. Playing live in a rock band, it's like you realize that no one is going to remember the mistakes that you made. They're just going to remember the feeling that they walked away with, you
yeah.
know? And so it really allows you to be in the moment and just let go and express the song and, you know, be in it with the audience. And it's actually kind of a magical experience when it goes right. So yeah, we play pretty hard, and that's what it's all about to me.
I rewrote the intro a couple times. I finally settled on indie rock band, and that was really unsatisfying to me. How
yeah.
would you describe the Shondas? Because I had queer in there, I had Jewish and klezmerite, all these different words, and I settled on indie rock band, and I'm not happy about it.
Yeah, well, you know, in the like elevator pitch version of the band, I also say indie rock, or sometimes I'll say, you know, we're a rock band with violin and female lead vocals or something. But, you know, it's hard because we are inspired by so many different kinds of music, and I think you can hear a lot of those other influences in there, some of them more than others. But yeah, the klezmer and also the like Jewish religious music, sort of more liturgical melodies, a lot of those minor raised sevenths and things like that that sound Jewy, and punk rock and Riot Girl and classical and, you know, all of these things. Even we've joked, you know, Broadway, but you know, one of the things that, you know, that we talk about in the, you know, in the band is that it's really not, the music isn't meant to be like fusion music, you know.
Right.
It's not supposed to be like rock fused with klezmer or fused with classical. It's really just about a more organic, like what we are inspired by. And what I think all of those things have in common, from classical to klezmer to punk rock, is like to Broadway, is really just a rawness of emotion.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the linking element between all of those things and, you know, and the common thread that I think they find in our band. And certainly Louisa, the way that Louisa sings is so emotional and raw and powerful. And so, yeah, I think that's sort of the common thread there.
Before we even get more into the Shondas, I need to be very upfront with you. I called my father right before we got on the phone together. He is not, I'm really being very honest with you, and he wants me to call him back after we're done talking because he is not happy with the name the Shondas.
Yes. Yes. Well, some of our families were not happy with the name either when we started it. For those of you who don't know, a Shonda is a Yiddish word. It means a shame or a disgrace. And, you know, for example, your grandparents might say, oh, you know, you're going out with a man that's such a Shonda, you
right.
know, like we don't want anyone to know, you know. So it's sort of, it's a negative word. But we, the reason we chose it was to sort of, to reclaim it in a similar way that, like, the queer community has reclaimed the word queer.
Yeah.
And, you know, taking something that is sort of marks our cultural heritage as Jews, and sort of reclaiming that as a positive thing, and especially because we've been very vocally, like, politically vocal, about, like, you know, a number of different issues from queer and trans rights to anti-racism to, like Israel-Palestine
yeah.
and all that sort of stuff. It's like, you know, for us, it's like, okay, well, if you want to tell us that we're a Shonda for, you know, for believing in queer rights, if you want to tell us that we're a Shonda for believing in Palestinian rights, then go ahead. You know, we're proud of that. We're embracing it. So I don't know how satisfying an answer that will be to your father, but I do understand the immediate perversion, and that was something we did actually talk about.
Well, let's put it in its context. I know that you're mentioning pretty hardcore Shondas in my family. If you went out with it, without your shirt tucked in. That really was a Shonda as well. So, you know.
Yeah, there's a broad range of Shonda.
Depends on, you know, I was on the New Jersey side. You were on the Long Island side. It was different. It was different.
Yeah, well, until I moved to Virginia, then it was really different.
I bet. One review described you guys as queercore, and you just said anti-racist as well. Queercore anti-racist activist, which if someone read that, they would assume, well, this must be spoken word music, and, you know, there's no notes. How do you all go about, you use the word vocalizing, which of course is one of our favorite words in 5 years of this show. You play your music, you put yourselves out there. How do you embody, and I do love these words, queercore anti-racist activists?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, we have a couple of songs with sort of more overtly political lyrics. You know, off our first record, The Red Sea, we have a song called I Watch the Temple Fall, which is about being pro-Palestine Jews. Mm-hmm. And on the next record that's coming up, we have a song called Sing for You, which is about misogyny in the music industry. So, you know, this does sort of, it does make its way into our lyrics, but I think more often than not, it's just sort of about how we position ourselves as people. You know, like, one of the things that we realized very quickly is that the press is much more interested in talking to a band than it is in talking to an activist group. And so, you know, just being able to say the words anti-racist in an interview and have it be printed anywhere is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
You know, for mainstream press. From that to doing benefits, you know, like having people when we're on tour, we'll have people, you know, come up on stage and talk about some of, like, you know, just really quickly in the middle of our set, you know, hey, this action is happening. If you're interested, come talk to me or sign this petition or, you know, whatever. So I think, you know, mostly it's about how we present ourselves non-musically, you know, and we're just sort of known for doing that sort of thing and for speaking out about issues and signing on to different political campaigns and stuff like that. But it does make its way into our lyrics sometimes.
Love it. Now, I would say that when, not if, but when the VH1 Behind the Music comes out about the Shondas, there's some drama there.
Yeah, it's true. Well, I want a pop-up video. I don't even know if they still do that. That was my favorite VH1 thing. But, yeah,
I do,
you know,
love pop-up video.
I know. Why is it so good? but, yeah, you know, I mean, I think Louisa and I, you know, are now the only two founding members of the band that are still together. And she and I were actually in a band before, and we've known each other and have been... We're like siblings at this point, you know, we've been friends for like, you know, 13, 14 years. And so, you know, there's a solid core there. But we have replaced, our original guitarist, Ian Branigan, we replaced with, Fury in 2008. And actually, you know, for real drama, our second album, My Dear One, that is really a breakup album is mostly about that experience. And then, in a much less dramatic fashion, we just this past winter, replaced our original drummer, with, Janine Fruchter with our, new drummer, Allison Miller. And that was a much, much more amicable parting work. You know, Janine is one of my best friends and, you know, will always be in the Shonda's family and all of that. But it has been a big shift. And so I think, you know, as musicians and people and artists, it's exciting to, you know, figure out how to take whatever life throws at you and make something positive out of it.
Yeah. When the Behind the Music comes out, will they say that you're like the Stevie Nicks of the group? I'm trying to figure out, you know, are you the Stevie Nicks? Are you the Belinda? I think you're the Belinda Carlisle.
I think, well, the way what some people have said to Louisa and I, which is definitely my favorite that I would like to embrace, is that I am the Clarence Clemens to her Bruce Springsteen. That is my personal
favorite. That's awesome. As a New Jersey native, that hits so close to home for me, and just I'm a little choked up right now.
Oh, God. I know. I feel so blessed to have seen Bruce before Clarence passed a couple of times, so I feel incredibly grateful for that experience. Those shows are definitely some of the most spiritually moving, intense experiences.
Yeah, you gotta love a show that has really no discernible end time.
Oh, no.
That could go on. Well, now, you wrote a piece for the Good Men Project. You know, I was kidding about getting choked up, but I again, I really did get choked up on this. You wrote a piece called The Pain of Indescribable Pain for the Good Men Project, and yeah. I will link to it on our site. It is one of the most incredible, hard-hitting, poignant narratives that I have read online. I kid you not, I was kind of dumbstruck by it, and put it in its context for us before I read a quote from it.
Yeah, sure. Well, the Good Men Project is a really interesting blog and forum for people talking about and sort of deconstructing masculinity from a really, I think, really wonderfully broad range of, you know, some of it is more academic and some of it is really very common language down to earth, as my piece is. And a dear friend of mine writes for them and asked me to write a piece about pain. It was a series, a theme about pain. And I had recently been through breast cancer, and I had surgery, and I went through a year of chemotherapy, and that would also be in the behind the music. That was what was going on during the recording of Church Life, our last
right.
record. And, you know, it was sort of just a real godsend that I was asked to write this piece. At first, I didn't think that I could do it, and then when I started writing, it just really came pouring out, and it was very you know, therapeutic for me to write and talk about that experience.
Incredible. It was incredible.
You
wrote in that piece, quote, "Growing up socialized as female, I always felt that I had to be tough and not show pain. I had to prove that I was strong, that I was good as a boy, that I deserve respect. I was often embarrassed and disappointed in myself because although being tough was important to me, I wasn't very good at it." Talk about using your voice. I mean, really, I was almost hesitant to bring up this piece because there's no way I feel like I can do it justice except to give it a shout out and to link to it and really urge people to go check it out. So
yeah, I mean, I just think that, you know, we could just talk about masculinity forever, but, you know, there are so many different forms of masculinity, and the pressures of masculinity are so intense and so various, and, you know, they play out differently for, you know, for straight men and queer men and trans men and, you know, genderqueer people and women, you know, too, and, like, just all of these different experiences. And I think that was one of the things, actually, that my friend who asked me to write the piece, that commented on that same quote, and he was just like, you know, it's so interesting that I would never have thought that, that you growing up female, you know, I'm trans, you know, would have experienced some of the same pressures of masculinity that I did, you know, that's what my friend said. So, you know, I think it's something I can hopefully bring us all together.
Oh my gosh. Incredible piece. We can't talk about it too much because I don't know if you know, in just a few weeks in September, The Garden is being released.
Yes. I'm extremely excited about The Garden. Like you said, it's our fourth record. It comes out September 17th. You'll be able to buy it online and iTunes and all that stuff, and probably in some stores too, but I won't list them. It was just, you know, if this was our first record with our new drummer. We went to Europe on tour this fall for the first time, and we got to play a lot of these songs live all across Europe before we recorded them. And it just, I feel like we're coming into our own in a big way, and it just feels really good.
And an accompanied zine is coming out with it, which these words, how great were these concepts? You wrote, you were looking for submissions that embodied brokenness plus wholeness, integration plus recovery, growing up again and again, staying strong plus remembering who you are, dreams, hope, faith, loss, and the idea of innocence.
Yeah, I think that was Louisa. The Garden, like, you know, that's the title of the record, and, you know, that's one of the most elemental, like, metaphors in our culture, you know, about, you know, innocence and the things we lose and being grown up and being cast out and all
right.
of these things. And, you know, in a way, it's like, okay, well, it's kind of silly to, you know, to have a theme like The Garden. It's like, but then you embrace everything that's, you know, good that's been said, has been said before by somebody else, and you just go for it if that's what's happening. And, you know, so that really is, those are the themes that that carry through the record, and I think that I hope that it manages to, you know, embody a lot of those questions and sorrows and losses and also still be uplifting. That's the idea anyway.
Well, we will be playing nights like these, and you will see there on your little private link that we're not giving out to people that the hit count went up for that one considerably, because I've listened to it like 6 times today. I enjoy it.
Excellent.
I enjoy
it. I'm
so
glad.
So we'll play that. I will say the good thing about you, and we will be balanced and know that there's something not so good coming up. The good thing about you is that I was checking out your YouTube channel. There are so many fun videos that I have never seen before. I had never heard the song. I don't know what this says about me. I had never heard the song Cool Jerk by the Go-Go's.
Yeah, I'm a big Go-Go's fan, for sure.
So that was so enjoyable.
Yes, very good.
So that's the good thing about you. The not great thing about you...
Bad.
Yeah, the not great thing about you, and I hate... Oh, gosh, I'm so uncomfortable outing you like this, but I do want my listeners to know that you did promise bagels that have not yet manifested in my mailbox.
Okay, well, I don't have your address,
Excuses.
Until I have your address.
All right,
it's
fine.
True, though, I did promise bagels. You know, I'm obviously not above bribery for press coverage. And, I think bagels are a fantastic form of bribery. So
that's awesome.
You just give me your address and they'll be on their way.
I'm a New Jersey gay Jew. It's going to work every single time. That's awesome. The name of the album, everyone, is called The Garden. It is coming out right there in the third week of September. We will be, of course, reminding you all to pick it up. Elijah, what an absolute treat having you on the show. I'm actually going to have you do something that only a handful of folks have done in the history of our show in 5 years and hundreds of episodes. And you're going to close out our show with the key words, and you'll know when to say it. Your key words are going to be so gay. Are you prepared?
Okay.
Okay.
Right.
You're
I'm
on
so
it.
Ready.
It's a big honor. So folks, get out there. Go do amazing things. Of course, our big thanks to Jimmy Nguyen, who was on earlier in the show. Please check out his new project, the Diverse Story Project, that we will be linking to. Of course, Elijah from the Shondas, their new album's coming out, and we will be playing right this very second, Nights Like These, to close out our show. Get out there and do incredible things. And of course, while you're doing them, please remember, why be gay when you can be
so gay.
I'm not waiting, I'm going big, 'cause I can't imagine much better than this. And I'm not waiting till I figure it out, 'cause I need a dream for right now. Lights up my name, a simple message.